Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When confronted with the unimaginable, sometimes the only thing you can do is concentrate on the things you can control and buy online. That's what Nina Riggs wrote about in her essay, When a Couch is More Than a Couch. Here's Oscar winner Kate Winslet reading Nina's piece.
Were I healthy enough these days, I would be sipping a glass of free wine and running my hands over an exquisite accent pillow in an impossibly hip showroom called something like Space or Lust, while a sales assistant speaks to me of the virtues of aniline versus semi-aniline leather. So you really think kiln-dried hardwood is worth the extra expense, I'd be asking? And does this come in a three-seater? Instead, I'm propped in bed on a dozen pillows with my laptop, perusing online furniture stores. West Elm, Joybird, Crate and Barrel, and something called Chair-ish. I am an internet sofa shopping fiend. I take breaks only when the oxy overwhelms me and my head starts to loll. I cannot rest until I have considered every mid-century modern with a hint of bohemian sofa the World Wide Web has to offer. I pore over design sites like Apartment Therapy, Design Sponge, and Domino, searching, searching. Since John and I married 16 years ago, we have never had a real grown-up couch. We have plenty of well-loved misfits, as-is IKEA specials, parental handoffs, Craigslist semi-miracles, and roadside rescues. First we were broke, and then we had babies. It never seemed like the right time to splurge on anything nice. And the misfits have been fine. We're not fancy, and our taste is eclectic. Our house is full of objects that are stronger on personality than looks. The wood box my father and uncle sat on as children to lace their boots for sledding, a lumpy chaise by the front window, in the world's coziest reading nook. Anyway, when we have needed to get down to the serious business of life, we have always preferred to retreat to our bed, our war room, cocoon, escape hatch, and, at times, dining room. But in the weeks after I learned that the breast cancer I have been in treatment for over the past year had spread to my bones, breaking my spine and becoming incurable and most likely fatal, finding the perfect living room couch has begun to feel like the most important thing I've ever done. Except just when I find one I love, it turns out I can't click buy now. And commitment issues have not generally been my problem. Houses, cars, job switching, kid having, plane ticket buying, restaurant choosing, shoe shopping, mastectomy, bring it. Usually, I just pick a good-seeming option and don't look back. Within 10 minutes of meeting John at a summer job at 21, I had already mentally signed on for life, although I waited at least a week to tell him that. But the couch, I can't do it. Maybe I'm holding off until after my next big oncology appointment, as though something my doctor may say will help determine whether I am willing to spend the extra money for Dacron bedding and poly-down cushions. She promised some new thoughts about treatment options, immunotherapy, clinical trials, off-label drugs, acupuncture, the dreaded watchful waiting. It's a complicated calculus. On the one hand, a basic cost-benefit analysis. How much money do I want to spend on something I may not be around to really enjoy? On the other, isn't buying an expensive couch a kind of lovely expression of hopefulness. And after I'm gone, don't I still want my guests in my home to feel comfortable and stylish? None of this was supposed to happen. At 38, I wasn't supposed to lie on my back in the ER on a late December morning and be told by a teary radiation oncology resident that the pain I'd been having for 2 months, that I'd been assured was from having a weak core after months of chemo, was actually from a tumor that had devoured my L2 vertebra. John wasn't supposed to have to hold me up on the toilet, put my pants on for me, do Christmas Eve for the children without me. I'm not supposed to be thinking about where he will sit and hold my hand as I take my last breath. Despite all the pamphlets the social workers gave us when I was in the hospital, we don't really know how to talk to our boys yet. They are 6 and 9. They know about the cancer and the back break, but they don't really know what it all means. Instead, I ask the 6-year-old, "What do you think of leather upholstery?" "Depends if it's slippery or nuzzly," he says. "Excellent point. I think I need to take any bonded leather options, no matter how cute or economical they seem, off my favorites list and go with the top grain." The day after the emergency surgery, when my doctor was sitting on the end of my bed in the oncology ward, I saw her glance toward those pamphlets that had been left on the bedside table. "What to tell your children about your progressive disease." She's a mother, too. Her children are only a couple of years older than mine. "Is it time to despair?" she said, during a pause in our discussion about pain management and radiation, maybe reading one of the pamphlet headings. "No," she proclaimed, staring straight at me. "No, it is not." I trust her completely. Even after the chemo failed twice and the cancer spread when she said it wouldn't, whatever it is in oncologists that makes them want to be oncologists, that crazy mix of fierceness, optimism, arrogance, and compassion, I get a contact high from it. It's like love at first sight or touching something on fire. It's like making a choice and refusing to look back. John is mildly new couch averse, but he's treading carefully. He knows me well enough to understand that when I'm dissertating on the merits of tufted cushions, I'm chewing on something else. "Custom upholstery? Really? With 2 boys? He asks, flipping through insurance statements on the counter. "Okay, well, I think you should get whatever you're into." One big upside of being told I have incurable cancer is that after all these years, my husband has finally stopped smugly saying, "It's your funeral," when I make a decision he doesn't agree with. "Did you spend thousands of dollars on the internet today?" he asks when he gets home from work, and finds me with my pillows and hot water bottles on the not-perfect couch where he left me in the morning, a low-slung rattan situation my parents bought as patio furniture in the early 90s. "Not today," I say. "Nice," he says. "Do you want to go get in bed together and stare at the ceiling?" I do. We do. In January, the afternoon already looks like evening. "Can you believe we found out you have incurable cancer on literally the darkest day of the year?" John asks as we hold hands and stare up toward the same blank spot above our bed. "Yeah, I totally can," I say. We both laugh. I have always loved the sound of him laughing. Soft and comfortable, understated, offbeat, with unmistakably sleek mid-century lines. He takes me gingerly in his arms, as if we are awkward teenagers. My back spasms, but I wiggle closer to him until I can put my head on his chest and hear his heart beating. Downstairs, the boys gaze at a screen on the old futon in the playroom. We will figure out what to do about them soon enough. They probably already know what's up and are waiting for us to figure out how to say it. Despite not being much of a Christmas person myself, I hated not being able to watch them open presents and can't bear the thought of never doing it again. Their very existence is the one dark piece I cannot get right within all this. I can let go of a lot of things. Plans, friends, career goals, places in the world I want to see, maybe even the love of my life. But I cannot figure out how to let go of mothering them. So maybe I don't try to figure it out. Maybe I just aim to get the couch right. Strong bones, high quality leather, something earthy and animal and real. A surface that knows something of what it was to be alive, that warms to our touch and cools in our absence. Also, an expansive bench that fits all of us. Something that will hold us through everything that lies ahead. The loving, collapsing, and nuzzling. The dying, the grieving. I know my thoughts have probably diverged from whatever John is thinking about in the near dark of our bedroom. He is silent. Maybe he's dozing. As I lie here, with John's chest rising and falling under my cheek, I realize that my careful calculations, how long do I have left? Who am I really buying this couch for? Am I getting a good deal? Are irrelevant. As in all things, I have to believe I'll know what's right when I see it.
That's Kate Winslet reading Nina Riggs' piece, When a Couch is More Than a Couch. Here's Kate.
The grace and humility with which she shared her experience of living and dying and the love she expressed to the very last moment inspired me enormously. And I lost my own mother last year, so this means a lot.
We've got more after the break.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Nina Riggs' Modern Love piece was published in September of 2016. 5 months later, she died in hospice. Nina left a memoir that she wrote over the course of her illness. It's called The Bright Hour, and in it she writes about her resolution to love the days that she was living with cancer as much as she'd loved the ones that had come before. Here's her husband, John Duberstein.
She really focused and really disciplined herself to love all the days. I don't think it was just that she was naturally disposed to. I think she saw clearly that if she didn't, she was going to waste whatever time she did have. That was a lot harder for me to see because for a long time, I could only see my children not having their mom and me not having the love of my life and my partner and my family and the structure of everything that we had built together. I think for me at the time, and I think this is indicative of the role of caregiver versus the role of the afflicted, you know, that person is grappling with mortality. They're grappling with, you know, losing everything, but they're also going to be the absence. They're going to be the thing that is gone. And I was grappling with the fact of losing her and going on. You know, we were together from the time that we were really barely just not kids. We met when Nina was a rising senior in college and I had just graduated from college, and we were married for almost 17 years. And I miss all of the shared memories, all of the inside jokes, the things that could be said without being said, the way that she would buy me clothes before I even know that I knew that I needed them, or that I could do little things for her, like get her coffee in the morning, or, you know, just small token things that became like you wouldn't go through a day without them.
John needed help getting through the days after Nina died. So he turned to a suggestion she'd made while in hospice. Get in touch with Lucy Kalanithi. Lucy is the widow of Paul Kalanithi, who wrote his own memoir about dying young with cancer. That's called When Breath Becomes Air. Lucy and Nina had written to each other during Nina's illness, and Lucy had read an advance copy of Nina's memoir. Here's Lucy.
Nina advised John to contact me after she died, which he did almost immediately, with this sort of long, desperate email written like in the middle of the night, grieving Nina 2 days after she died or something. And it was so, it felt so familiar and also kind of crazy, but Nina was the character reference, you know, like I'd already fallen in love with Nina. And then to hear from John, who was this character that I knew reasonably intimately from her memoir, I was drawn to write back to him. And so we started writing to each other and kept writing to each other and kept writing to each other and then fell in love.
Lucy and John are in a relationship, something he says he could have never imagined happening in the midst of his grief.
I don't think it could have possibly happened, but I think the fact that we had such a common set of understandings about the ramifications of grief and the process of grief, and then we were just incredibly lucky. I mean, both of us have a similar approach to a lot of that stuff. We have similar values around things like, how do you care for one another's emotions? How do you care for your emotions around your lost partner? How do you care for your child's emotions? Those are the things that I think probably make being partnered the most meaningful and the most likely to succeed long term.
It's the first relationship for each of them after losing their spouses. And they know, perhaps better than anyone else, the risk that comes with love.
I think the danger is maximal. But I think both of us having walked somebody through such suffering and, you know, seeing them die and being connected during that time and then losing them, we both have a sense of the profundity of what it means to be in that type of relationship and what the extremes of a relationship like this are. The risk that you're taking on in falling in love, whether it means the relationship could end, of course, or you love each other forever and then one of you will lose each other at the end of your lives. So, you know, it's like one of the biggest risks we all take. And I think both of us have a sense of what that means. And it's terrible and great. The third anniversary of Paul dying is about to come up. And in a way, I don't feel any different about that as I did on the first anniversary or the second anniversary, you know, relating to the sadness of Paul having died and missing Paul. And now I'll do that with John next to me. But it's not different.
It's a lot to manage. It's a lot to carry. And we just passed the one year anniversary of Nina's death, and I expected it to be difficult, and it still exceeded my expectations of how difficult it was. But you can't view it as, I can't handle this on top of whatever else I've got. I can't do relationship on top of grief, or I can't do relationship on top of having kids or whatever it is. It's, you know, it's life, and the grief and the person that you're missing are going to be there alongside that the whole rest of the way. And I guess it's up to us to sort of honor that and put all of our energy into enjoying all the days that we've got in front of us.
And when it comes to their own story, there's one word they keep coming back to: lucky.
Yeah, I think it is, like, how crazy is that to say lucky, you know? And I think for me, I really have been able to learn to embrace that duality, right, of like love and loss and pain and joy. And I think it's really deep and rich and lucky.
After the break, the couch.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
A side note to this piece is after it was published, one of the strange but touching outpourings was all these offers of free brand new couches. By the time the piece came out, I think she already had a couch. But it was, you know, people just want to do something. They get moved and they want to offer advice and they want to reach out and help somehow. But that was just repeated over and over again, are these offers of free couches and advice on finishes and surfaces and durability and all of that, almost like everyone else was in denial, too, and wanted to focus on the couch in the same way that Nina did.
Nina bought a two-seat caramel leather couch. It sits in the North Carolina home where John lives with their two boys, Benny and Freddie, who John says are both doing well. And that couch is also part of another amazing coincidence.
The couch, the couch that the piece is about, Lucy has that
same couch.
And had it before Nina did.
John and Nina's younger son, Benny, likes to sit on that couch, reading or playing with Legos when he comes home from school, because it satisfies his most important requirement.
It is real leather. It's nuzzly. Just so you know.
Yes. She followed Benny's directions to a T.
Just so you're not stressed out about it. It's nuzzly.
Next week on the podcast, Rosie Perez.
He put his hands on my hips. I put my arms around his waist. And just like that, we were dancing under the glare of a streetlight to music coming out of someone else's SUV. And I was still 40, and he was still 21 and a half when he kissed me. So I kissed him back. Or it may have been the other way around.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.